United States against Dahlhaus.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is
Ms. Schroeder.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Hillary Schroeder, and I am a senior law student practicing with a 7-Eleven license. I represent defendant appellant Jermaine Dahlhaus in this matter. Mr. Dahlhaus was incorrectly convicted on the strength of his own uncooperated out-of-court statements regarding marijuana use. These statements were erroneously admitted at the trial court level without a finding that the statements were corroborated by substantial independent evidence as required by...
Mr. Schroeder, what does this have to do with rules of admissibility? I understand the argument that corroboration is necessary for conviction, but why is it important to the admission of evidence?
In the United States versus Howard, the circuit decided that jury instructions were not required on the issue of corroboration because it would be a factual determination made by the judge at the trial court level.
Yes. I still don't see why it has to do with the admission of evidence. The rule says that all relevant evidence is admissible.
Correct.
And the confession, I should think, is obviously relevant evidence. It is not by itself sufficient for conviction, but we don't have a rule that says no evidence is admissible unless it's sufficient by itself for conviction. So that's why I'm having trouble with the idea that this is a rule of evidence.
Well, this is a rule of evidence in that the trial court needs to make a finding of corroboration before it allows the evidence.
And that doesn't make it a rule of evidence. Has nothing to do with the admissibility of the confession. That's my problem. Was there an argument, let me put it differently, was there an argument made in the district court under Rule 29 for acquittal on the ground that the evidence, all of the evidence once it's admitted, is not sufficient for conviction?
No, the trial counsel did not make a sufficiency of the evidence argument.
Yeah, one would think that that's the way to bring this up as a Rule 29 motion.
Traditionally, it has been brought up as a Rule 29 motion. However, after reading Howard,
Of course, it's not your fault that the trial lawyer didn't do it. You're stuck with it, but still.
But after reading the United States versus Howard in the circuit, in which we said that we aren't going to allow a jury instruction on cooperation, or we don't require a jury instruction on cooperation, the court at that time cited the opinions of Dickerson and Singletary in the First Circuit and the D.C. Circuit, which both explicitly say that the corroboration, like other admissibility issues, is best decided by the trial court and the trial judge.
Now, in order to say that Mr. King's testimony did not suffice as corroboration, mm-hmm. wouldn't we have to say that this man was incredible as a matter of law? And is it possible for us to say that? I mean, he had substantial credibility problems, mm-hmm. but couldn't a jury still credit him?
Well, I have two responses to that. The first is that even if someone could, which we do not think that they could, find Mr. Dahlhaus credible, his testimony is so dubious that we would expect an actual finding of fact in the record that his testimony could corroborate Mr. Dahlhaus's statements. But additionally, to whether or not his testimony was incredible as a matter of law, I would suggest at the trial court level, he admitted that he was probably stoned on crack, but he couldn't remember. He testified that he was capable of remembering events if he had only consumed a little alcohol or a little marijuana, and then he proceeded to testify that he probably was on crack, had drinking a lot of alcohol, and possibly had smoking a lot of marijuana, suggesting that, no, he couldn't remember events. He forgot his original story to the police. He made inconsistent statements about how Mr. Dahlhaus approached the police about the handgun, which he claims to have witnessed it. So I would suggest that his testimony was so dubious that it would be akin to a witness suggesting that they had seen something when they had actually been on the other side of a wall. I would say it was incredible as a matter of law. Furthermore, at the trial court level, the government suggested that they were capable of corroborating Mr. Dalhouse's statements by introducing evidence that Mr. Dalhouse did indeed own a handgun and that Mr. Dalhouse was aware of an individual named Ricardo. Although Mr. Dalhouse did mention those facts contemporaneously with discussing the fact that he had been a marijuana smoker, we suggest that there is no way that those statements are of the type that they could corroborate the reliability of his statements regarding marijuana use. Ownership, legal ownership of a handgun, does not in any way support a jury inference that statements about marijuana use might be true. Similarly, the fact that Mr. Dalhouse was aware of an individual named Ricardo would not in any way support a jury inference that his statements about using marijuana could possibly be true.
I must tell you, I agree with you that corroboration as to possession of the gun and his familiarity with someone named Ricardo is beside the point, because these were legal activities, and nothing in the corroboration of these points made it more likely that Dalhouse's admission to using marijuana, which after all is the illegal activity, was accurate. But Mr. King's testimony did corroborate Dalhouse's confession to the marijuana use. And if we go back around to the...
Right. Again, Mr. King's testimony, we submit that it's incredible as a matter of law. But even if you think that there is some juror out there who might possibly have believed Mr. King's testimony, or in this case, that the trial court could have possibly found that his testimony had enough credibility to lend itself to corroborate Mr. Dalhouse's statements, it's such a stretch that you would have expected to see the trial court to make that finding a fact on the record and make it clear that that is what the trial court was considering when deciding to allow Mr. Dalhouse's statements in. If there are no more questions, I will reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Grimmer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Don't let him see your notes.
To the extent that there are shortcomings in the record, when it came time to admit the videotape statement, I take full responsibility because I was the trial counsel. And I do think that appellate counsel pointed out those shortcomings. However, I do think that at the time that we were attempting to introduce the videotaped confession, we were aware of the concerns that might be raised. We did present the trial court with a bench memo, and I know that counsel, although he did not move for a judgment of acquittal, also cited law to Judge Sharp, and he had the opportunity to review that law before making a determination. I think that when one looks at a record, a cold record, as appellate counsel had to do here, and study, I guess, the testimony of Wingding, Chris King, certainly there is a lot of baggage, and certainly you can question, as was argued below, the credibility of Chris King or Wingding.
It is such, here's this fellow. He says he has memory problems when he's too intoxicated. As he testified, he had smoked marijuana. He had consumed a lot of cognac. He was probably high on crack cocaine on June 22nd. Really, how do we rely about his testimony about the events of June 22nd?
Well, I think that it's been characterized that testimony was worthless, at least in appellant's brief, and that the jury must have concluded the same. And I respectfully disagree, because I think that jurors are the best judges of credibility when it comes to witnesses like this. And every day, I believe, in our courtrooms, government attorneys present witnesses with this kind of baggage. This was a properly instructed jury when it came to the credibility of Chris King. They were certainly told about all of his warts and how they may use his prior convictions, his inconsistent statements. That was all before the jury, and it was argued by counsel for Jermaine Dalhouse about the credibility of Chris King. I believe that in terms of saying that his testimony was incredulous as a matter of law, I think would probably...
I think incredible. Judge Rovner is the one who's incredulous.
Thank you. I think that it might... We might be beginning to go down a path that I think is a dangerous one in terms of asking this court to judge the credibility of witnesses even when there is extensive baggage. So I guess from that standpoint, I would ask the court to simply look. There were some redeeming qualities about Mr. King.
And baggage is a good word. All too many witnesses appear in court looking like Jacob Marley.
And the corroboration rule doesn't require much. I mean, it doesn't require evidence that on its own would be enough to support conviction.
It does require that the statement, I mean, it looks to trustworthiness. And that's really the purpose of the rule. And so I think Judge Sharp also had an opportunity to listen to Chris King. And certainly he was an experienced trial judge. But he understood that the credibility issue was going to be a big factor. But when
forgive me. Sure. But Judge Sharp's analysis leaves a lot to be desired. He seems to have, I mean, God bless him and I love him, but he seems to have focused on the fact that Dalhouse's confession was videotaped. But the videotape simply eliminates doubt that Dalhouse, in fact, confessed. It doesn't corroborate the confession. The judge made this remark that he wasn't sure what the objections were, and that suggests that he wasn't quite focused on the right point.
Well, on page 72 of the trial transcript, volume 1, Your Honor, the court, Judge Sharp, says, "It is my impression, and tell me if I'm wrong, you could almost rest your case right now and get to the jury." And I believe that, and you have to remember, Judge Sharp also focused on the Howard case. And the facts of the Howard case, as Judge Sharp said, were close. I mean, from his perspective, he felt that the Howard case was what he was going to hang his hat on. So I do think, could I have done a better job in terms of getting the court to elicit the cooperation? You bet I can. That's my job as a trial lawyer. And if I failed in that responsibility, then so be it. It's there. But
well,
I do
not
think...
Not when you have, you know, drunken, crackhead, memoryless witness.
But he was...
Don't blame yourself.
Well, but the other side of it is that the jury had a chance to see the questions put to Mr. King by myself and cross-examined. And yes, there are other things that he said, his demeanor, how he answered the questions, how he explained his motive for testifying. All of that was in front of the fact finder and properly instructed on the credibility. So yes, I do think that in terms of what it was out, it was all laid out there for the jury to hear.
Well, his motive is not to spend the rest of his life without cognac, crack, and marijuana.
Well, he explained what his motive was, but also before the jury was the fact that he was going to get a letter written. He was hoping to get out. He has 7 kids. He's been in prison before. He knew how the system worked. I mean, that's a realistic appraisal of it. But again, all of that, there was none of that that was left unturned that the fact finder didn't have. And I would submit that when it came to the issue of cooperation on the uses of marijuana, you have obviously Mr. Dalhouse's statements, but were they independently corroborated? And Mr. King does provide that, and perhaps maybe that is in fact the for whatever reason, Mr. Dalhaus chose to associate himself with Mr. King. As Judge Sharp used to tell us, there are no swans in the sewer when we would present sometimes these kind of witnesses for purposes of deciding credibility issues, and he would tell us, and we would hear that. So as a practical matter, I do think that there was cooperation on the marijuana usage, to answer your question. And yes, it doesn't require an awful lot. But ultimately, the court has to look to the issue of, and the purpose of the rule is was this statement trustworthy?
This corroboration rule is a common law rule that predates Miranda.
It does, Your Honor. And I think Smith and Oper talk about that, and it's evolved in the Howard case and the cases that have been decided in this circuit talk about that. But ultimately, I still think that we're concerned, and we should be concerned, that law enforcement and that people should not be convicted simply based on their statements. I mean, the rule is there to make sure we do our job.
And Judge Sharp's comment about the fact that this was a videotaped confession as opposed to one that the officer took down and got the defendant to sign, which is a little different sort of an animal in terms of confessions, really bears on that trustworthiness inquiry and the trustworthiness underpinnings of the rule itself.
That's a good analogy, Your Honor. I quite frankly, when we were setting up, I am technologically challenged, and certainly we had to bring someone else in, and the record shows that, to be able to play the DVD, and I apparently disrupted Judge Sharp's train of thought. So to the extent that I said I'd take responsibility for the shortcomings, clearly my lack of ability to deal with a DVD player caused the problem.
But the whole point of videotaping a confession is to
correct
enhance its trustworthiness.
It does, absolutely.
Hope you're not confessing that the U.S. attorney is looking into departing from the Age Discrimination and Employment Act on the ground that older assistants can't handle the technology.
That's part of my job performance. I'm working on it. Any other questions?
No, but you look very young to me.
Thank you. And I did very much appreciate the work done on this particular brief. When I first got the brief, Your Honor, from the appellant, I had to read it several times. It was very well written. It caused me pause initially until I started digging into the law. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Ms. Schrader, anything further?
Mr. Grimer suggests that the jury was fully instructed on Mr. King and they had the opportunity to pass judgment on him. And that may be true, but the jury did not receive an opportunity to pass judgment on the issue of cooperation. The jury was not told that in order to consider Mr. Dalhaus's testimony, they first had to decide whether or not Mr. King's testimony was reliable enough to speak to the reliability of Mr. Dalhaus's statement. And that's something we should keep in mind when it does not appear that the trial court...
Well, if the jury was instructed, or maybe I have the record wrong, but wasn't the jury instructed insofar as its evaluation of the confession is concerned to consider the confession in light of all the evidence and that sort of thing? I mean, that's the usual confession instruction, right?
I do believe that they were instructed to consider the circumstances of the confession, and I also believe that they were instructed, in all fairness, to take into account the more unsavory details of Mr. King's life. However, they were not instructed on cooperation, and it does not appear the trial court made a ruling on cooperation, so that there was none either by the trial court or the jury. Again, it's important to make the ruling on the record so we can see and we can go and do an appeal and do a review and try to understand what happened. Mr. Grimer pointed out that I may have had to comb the facts of the trial record and try to piece together what happened. In this instance, I think it would have only taken the trial court a few extra seconds to say, we find cooperation from X fact or X piece of evidence. So it's not a very high cost. And finally, I do agree that videotaping is a good policy and that confessions should be videotaped to help police against coercive police tactics. However, it doesn't speak to everything that the initial cooperation requirement that was voiced in Smith and Opper speaks to. Smith and Opper was also worried about those who might be mentally ill or those who might be confessing for the wrong reasons because they don't fully understand the system or don't fully understand what they're implicating, not just people who are under the threat of police brutality.
Well, have those rationales dropped out of the rule now that we have Miranda? Or stated differently, have those rationales survived since Miranda?
I do believe they have survived Miranda. Miranda is about voluntariness. I'm not arguing that Mr. Dollhouse's statement wasn't voluntary. Nothing in the videotape or at the trial suggested he made an involuntary statement, and I believe that's what Miranda is essentially about. If there are no further questions, we would like to ask you to vacate Mr. Dollhouse's sentence.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Schrader, we appreciate your willingness and that of the Legal Aid Clinic to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to both your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement.